Welcome to Business by Design, a podcast that explores the evolving nature of design leadership and how to scale design's impact in the world. Business by Design is brought to you by Tech Circus, leaders in curating inspirational content for inspired professionals, and me, your host, Martin Dowson. I care deeply about the impact that design can have in the world, and as a designer, psychologist, and management consultant, I'm acutely aware of the fact that this impact is more often than not mediated through business. In this podcast, we will address the need for more business acumen in design careers, especially at a leadership and executive level. We will talk with CDOs, design directors, design educators, academics, and consultants, exploring how each of them see the future of design leadership and its impact on the world.
The maturity of the company and the structure of the company are two aspects that really matters in how you set up your agenda and what you actually need to do. Maturity is about both about the understanding of the organization as a whole, about what design is and what impact design can have. And it's also about the maturity of design organization and design function in how ready the function is to achieve the goals and the ambition of the company.
In this episode, I'll be joined by Pernilla Johansson, who, as we were recording, was stepping away from her role as CDO of Electrolux. Pernilla reflects with me on her role as an executive member of the Electrolux leadership team, how her role as a design leader changed with becoming a chief design officer, and how she approached the ambition to increase the impact of design at Electrolux. Our conversation spans the deeply thoughtful efforts that she went to connect with every member of the design team, through to the attention paid to the organisational context and the business model through which Electrolux was operating, and through which the executive team she was part of were leading. And I think what you'll find in this conversation is a rare thing, a leader who has managed to navigate, understand and leverage the commercial and organisational reality of a corporation, seed a bottom-up cultural change and place design as a collaborator for how to achieve the business outcomes through mindsets without losing what Leslie Witt has referred to as the mother tongue of design. I'm grateful to Pernilla for sharing her observations at this inflection point in her career. It was a real privilege to be in conversation with her at this moment and to be able to share that with all of you so that we can all reflect and learn from it. So let's dive right in. Pernilla, welcome to the Business by Design podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to a really great conversation.
Yeah, me too. I've really been looking forward to this one. We've been getting to know each other a bit over the last 3 to 4 months, maybe even a bit longer, actually, when we first started talking about the Business by Design conference, which, as we're recording this, finished just a couple of weeks ago. So I've been really looking forward to the chance to actually get into conversation with you. And it's been great getting to know you over this period and just hearing a lot about your journey as a chief design officer. I'm always fascinated as somebody that's worked mostly in digital experiences and a little bit of in-person experiences. I'm just geekily fascinated by the world of actual physical product design. So it's always a pleasure to talk to somebody who has that background in their experience. But for our audience, would you mind just giving them a little kind of potted history introduction to Pernilla and where you're at? Thanks.
Yeah. So I'm Swedish by background, and had one of those kind of like childhoods which moved me between 8 addresses in 8 years. So I guess I was born a nomad and studied industrial design in Sweden. But during my study, already expanded myself by working as interns in different consultancy organizations to kind of like know what design was about. And then I have had 2 legs of my careers, you may say. The first one was the leg with Philips Design that brought me around the world. Started in Eindhoven, France, US, and Singapore. And through that leg, it was very much about I think you can say that the first 5 years I spent on being a designer within four different categories and learned the ropes of working with others and, you know, making use of research in the right way to ensure that you had the right foundation for what you were doing, and always worked very much on identifying the right process of design to be able to work collaboratively with others. And then after those 5 years, it was more about I became a leader of design and went quite fast up to directing the home entertainment category. And I grew with the whole DVD business in that time, which was exponentially changing, right? And I think there was the perfect, you know, first leg. It really sort of like defined me as a design leader working cross 360 touch points. You know, I was art directing photo shoots as well as I was, you know, working with R&D and marketing across the business to get the right proposition out to our market, and even developed commercial acumen in that time. And then then I moved to Electrolux, and I had kind of like this mindset of you have to resign at least once in your life, and the opportunity to set up a studio in Singapore from scratch was just too good of an opportunity. So that's what I did, and brought that to where it's kind of like is today, over a 6 year period before I was asked to come back to Sweden.
Wow.
And then I did a global journey with the small appliances, really working on the repositioning of that range. And then I was asked to take on the function. And that's what brought me to our conversation today, I guess.
Yeah. Wow. Fantastic. What a journey. I mean, it's no secret to listeners of the podcast and people that know me that I'm a total fanboy of Philips. But it also, funnily enough, Philips then led me to, you know, think more about and understand a bit more about Electrolux as well. And I've discovered in my conversations with people, especially in European design, that there is this quite a heritage amongst these companies of designers and design leaders and the experiences that it built up with these companies. So it's brilliant to be able to talk to you about it. So you know the theme of this podcast and also the conference that you so wonderfully contributed to is about the role of executive design leadership and the business acumen that feel like is needed more in design. That's the observation that's led us to some of these conversations. And I'm really interested in your perspective on your own journey as a chief design officer. It's a role that is being talked about a lot by people, has many different meanings depending on the company and the context. And, you know, one of those roles where we can talk about chief design officer, chief, normally meaning C-suite, normally meaning a particular hierarchical level. But on this podcast, we talk about it as meaning having some kind of executive responsibility, no matter where that reporting line is. So I'd be interested to understand a little bit more about your journey to becoming CDO and how that transition happened and what that was like.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I was asked to apply for that position, I must admit that I hesitated because I knew that maybe what we needed to do and what the role needed to be was maybe not exactly what the job description was stating.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I knew that, I mean, you've had other people on this conversation that, you know, when you're a design leader, you have a certain love for the craft and leading designers and leading designs. And I know that in the context of Electrolux, which is very much of a regionalized driven organization, it was a slightly different job description. It was not any longer about leading design and leading designers. And it was more about being that executive member, understanding the company strategy and drive, you know, design through towards that. And that was what was exciting about it, right?
Yeah.
And what my motivation in a way for actually applying and taking on the job was very much about increasing the impact of design in Electrolux. That was That was my motivator. And then I think every, when you look at it, every company has its, let's say the maturity of the company and the structure of the company are two aspects were really matters in how you sort of like set up your agenda and what you actually need to do. So if you think about the structure in a highly regionalized operation is different from a global operations, right? That you have to take that in consideration. And then maturity is about both about the understanding of the organization as a whole about what design is and what impact design can have. And it's also about the maturity of design organization and design function in how ready the function is to achieve the goals and the ambition of the company. So to kind of like crystallize that thought, it's both about understanding the ambition of the organization and the current state of the organization and the current state of the design function and how the design function can then increase their impact to support the ambition of the company and what are then the challenges that you have at hand. And and one of the things that was extremely important to me when I started this role was I wanted to ensure that I was addressing it as a design thinker, because I knew that that would make me enjoy the job more than if I didn't, right? So I thought, well, I've been working for decades on understanding users, customers, consumers, etc., and directing teams towards those solutions. So I can now do the same by understanding the organization and the designers and the stakeholders and the outside world and draw this map on what we need to do to get there, right? So that was that was my starting point. And when I did that, I mean, I had a lot of assumptions and a lot of my own opinions on it, but I really wanted to make sure that I worked with an outside-in perspective. So I did start with maybe some things that started as a little bit of a fun exercise, but turned out to be extremely valuable. And that was to ask the design organization, all the designers in the design function, to write me a thank you letter. And the idea was that they would write me a thank you letter which was dated like 2 years ahead of time, so that they thanked me for what we as a community had been able to achieve. And I got like over 50,000 words, which I got a little bit of help. Well, actually what I did was I told them, you know, no one's going to see the original mail but me. So I asked for full trust. So I asked, I also told them, you know, I will take away everything personal and then have it synthesized. And then we had a copywriter that turned this into the letters. But what that meant was that I also got a lot of trusts from individuals, and I got a lot of information on backgrounds, on you know, where things needed to maybe be improved in regards, it could be about leadership or climate or just how things were structured and managed. And it was really a wealth of information. Also discovering that each team in the organization was on different maturity levels, and we had different problems in different areas. So with that in my, you know, backbone, I also partnered with an external company, Park, to do a proper benchmark in looking at what does best-in-class design organization look like in different industries around the world. And they did also a analysis of our maturity level and where we were on it. And I think we could conclude that from that exercise was that, you know, we had a very mature, even though we could be increasing our strategic influences and impact in the field of physical product solutions, but we were very, very immature when it came to understand the need for digital design and how digital design should be integrated in the organization for an effective mm-hmm. product solution. And we were nowhere when it came to understanding design as a service, either for our customers or even looking at service design as methods and tools for our overall organization, because that's where you're, if you're really mature, that's where you are able to apply design thinking and service design in the broader context, right? And we were also, I would say, on our communication design, we were rather opportunistic. We had designers embedded in marketing in some places, but in other places in the design team that worked to support marketing, but more when mm-hmm. the marketing organization really wanted and saw the value of it. Varies when you what the need is and what the market looks like and where mm-hmm. you get the best value. So it was very understandable that we were very different in that field. And with all that wealth of information and and of course plenty of conversations with stakeholders, the leadership team, I call it like a round table leadership team, because I don't like to look at organizations as hierarchical, but much more of, we all had different roles to play. And I would say we were almost like Arthur around the round table, where mm-hmm. where we worked together to really define the culture and the climate and the organization that we wanted to achieve. That's kind of what we started off. Cool. And then, was the roadmap we set. And then we started activating it.
There's so much to unpack in that.
First of all, you started off with just talking about the, I think it was actually it's like five different things or four different things, which is the ambition of the company. And then the impact the design can have with that, then needing to understand the maturity of the organization and the maturity of the design organization. And I do find this is interesting. Sometimes people talk about doing maturity studies and they look at the design team, but they don't look at the organization, you know, and it's kind of, well, where's your context?
Exactly. And both is important.
And then also the nature of the organization that you're in, whether that's the commercial nature, the structural nature of it, as you said, regional, so many different things to try to get your head around, to work out what your organization inside that organization can do to be in the right place. And I was actually, as I was listening to that, I was thinking, did you do anything formal on maturity? But then of course you mentioned Park, who are quite well known for helping in this way. And there's quite a few chief design officers who have used them in this way. Other consultancies are available, of course. I'm not on any commission from Park, but I've heard about them quite a few times with this. Did you find that, just out of interest, did that help that there was a consultancy coming and helping you do the bench? Did that help with other stakeholders outside of design, or were they not involved in that?
No, it helped with the credibility of our own plan to have it in context. I think that's the key. It was making it clear that the plan and the strategy was founded in an external benchmark. I think that's beneficial.
One of the comments that Jose had from his PhD work, he was with me a couple of episodes ago, was the advice that stakeholders and boards and excos are having from external about design does have an impact on how they decide to ask for design, as it were, you know, and whether they set it up for success. But in an organization like yours, where design had existed for so long, was there a moment with your stakeholders where there was a reason why this was the change to make? You know, you mentioned, you know, when you were looking at the offer of taking up this role, you could see, you know, quite a bit of navigation to do ahead. Was there a moment or a context for the organization why that was happening then?
There was a very clear purpose set for the company. Mm-hmm. So the company had forged like a really powerful direction. And then our CEO at the time sustainability has always been in the core of Electric.
Yeah.
So, and that became even more important, it became the purpose of our existence. Mm-hmm. And I really like that, because that means that everyone in the company, all functions in the company are having a shared goal and what we call teamship, which is really allowing us to work towards the same goal with transparency and all that stuff, right? So my challenge was to ensure that the designers that were at the table in this purpose-led ambition was both skilled and capable, and that we had the right disciplines to be able to support the ambition, and also the right level of leadership level so that they could increase their impact and their influencing ability in the organization, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of it was to work on their understanding of what is a design leader and what should you expect and how can you build your leadership from within, because I don't believe that leadership is a title. It's everyone from designer to director are leaders from within their context, right? So I actually started with built a design leadership seminar that I took on world tour, that I spent like half a day with each team, where I shared my own experiences and the learnings that I've had as a design leader to empower them with both tools and I guess also for them to see that, you know, we all have been there. I understand where they're coming from and where their challenges are. And I think now when I'm leaving my role in Electrolux, that is one of those things that the team really remembers as a really good learning, and it really elevated them. And then, of course, with that, a competence framework and a structure that allowed designers to step up in different seniorities to practice their influencing level at different scales. That was another very important aspect.
So I think it's fascinating, actually, because the way that you're describing that to me sounds like a lot of the aspects of an end goal that, I mean, I think we can all have different perspectives on what design orgs should look like and how they work and how they have impact. So this is opinion of Martin, but I think others, you know, share it in ways, which is that in the end, you want to be able to have a team who are bringing their craft and their discipline to have impact in the organization, that their leadership comes from, or their impact comes from, helping the organization solve problems in a business and human way. That most designers would say that's what it's about. It's not about what is my title and how senior am I, and, you know, it's not about the hierarchy. However, a lot of people faced with not feeling like they're having the right impact switch to, so maybe it's because we don't have seniority. Maybe it's because we're not in the, because we see the rest of the organization behaving hierarchically. And what I'm hearing from this, which I find is really fascinating, is just this organization has already got designers in lots of different places. You mentioned before, of course, there were differences in maturities, but going in and then just enabling people where they are, empowering people where they are, giving them skills where they are is elevating. And your role as CDO has already got some hierarchical acknowledgement, but you're not using that. You were, I don't know, maybe I'm putting
words right.
But it sounds like you were using the designers, not your role.
I actually did. And, right. And one of the
Brilliant.
Things which I felt very, I guess, you know, I've been always working on a scale of having maybe between 25 to 50 designers in a team. And I've had direct access to each one of those individuals. And you can do that when you are at that scale, right? And here I was suddenly, you know, addressing a 200 people organization. And then traditionally, I think you would address the management community. But I needed, because I was really working towards a cultural change, I wanted to have access to all levels in the design team. And I guess that's why I did the letters, because that allowed me to get access to everyone without stepping on anyone's toes, right? So, I think that is another thing that the designers come back to me now saying, you know, we all had a voice. We all gained a voice. We felt heard. Mm-hmm. We felt seen. We felt that we had access. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that is super important for designers. They need to have access. And that means not just to, you know, their head, but it means their customers, their users, their their stakeholders. Because if they always work through a filter of other functions, they will not be able to produce the high impact work, which they can if they understand all aspects. I mean, I have so many own personal experiences on this. I remember, you know, working in Philips, and I was sent on world tours to meet with customers in all corners of the world. It was an amazing experience, right? And I would develop over the years, I go back to the same, you know, target customer in the US, for example, to mention one. And then suddenly there was maybe a problem with the customer had an issue with one of our products that was about to go to market or even existing in the market. And the sales guy had addressed that problem to the account manager, who had addressed it to the product line leader, who addressed it with me. And by the time, you know, it had moved between four different people. And I really didn't understand the problem. I didn't know what to do with it. So I said, can I have, because I met this person, can I have a direct contact? Can I call them? And so we arranged a call, and I had solved the problem in 5 minutes. And I had so many of those experiences that if you actually get to the root cause, if you get to the the root issue or the owner of the problem, you can solve things so much faster and so much easier. So, I mean, that's not only designers that had that need, but designers are, I would say, at least or even more particularly in the need of closing that gap between them as creators and the users and the stakeholders of the problems.
It's a fundamentally collaborative discipline. And so the increasing idea that we shouldn't be designing on our own, that we are actually co-designing and co-creating. And there's a place for individual creativity inside that as well to inject things into it. I was wondering whether, as you're doing that seeding and that working with the team, truly elevating them, what the things were that you needed to do as the CDO role and as a leader to pave the way for how they would then behave. So if you empower me and engage me with understanding more commerciality, understanding how I need to get more access to my stakeholders, what did you need to do to make it okay for them to then be the way that you'd encourage them to be? Were there changes that you needed to put? And was that something about your role as CDO that kind of came out then? So after doing the bottom up, what next?
Yeah, I mean, I think two angles to that. One connects back to what we actually talked about in the previous question about, you know, the definition of design and what it actually means. And one of the things that was clear to me that in the company, the general understanding of design was actually the meaning of the what, you know, what you designed, the end result of it. And that's often something that then, you know, looks good, works good, and brings value to our consumers. What I try to do in simplifying my language a lot, because I realized a lot that I underestimating a lot of times the difficulties for non-designers and non-design leaders to actually understand design. So I try to simplify it to the terms of, well, if you think about something that you would call this is designed, it's often something that stands out, which is differentiated, that is unique, and often very innovative. And it can stand out in different ways, right? But it is definitely standing out. It's something that is setting itself apart from what's out there. That's a designed thing. And if you, as a designer, you know that when you have been able to achieve such a result, you've been through a really great design process. You know that you have had a very clear understanding of what you wanted to achieve. You've had, you know, the right vision in place. You've had, you know, everyone in the project team aligning around that vision, and you worked extremely collaboratively to make sure that the output is of the standard that everyone, including yourself, is expecting, right? So what For others, maybe design is a output of something concrete, it digitally or physically or whatever. But for designers, the importance is the how of design. Because when you've got that in place, you know that the rest will be unfold. Trust the process is kind of like a favorite. You know, set out the conditions, trust the process, and then, you know, the great result will unfold itself. Yeah. So that's why I focused more on the how than on the what in influencing the organization. And part of that was also about how we actually were creating solutions, because we had a very typical process, which was talking about what needed to be delivered at what particular time, and then different functions delivered into those milestones.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily help you being as collaborative as you need to be to get to that deliverable, you know, with everyone being aligned around it. And then I'd observed the teams starting to kind of like create pre-meetings for pre-meetings to managing, you know, the output and the delivery points, but those were not formal milestones. So very often design was working in the past in a silo until it was time to unveil and deliver something. And and that needed change. So what we were working over these last years was as well to actually get a company-wide process in place that were design thinking based or mindset based, and had, so everyone now will kind of work towards the same mindset, the same process, same methods and tools. Because if everyone has the same ways of working, you will have a much stronger team shape in the end, because everyone can set shared goals, everyone can set the shared ambitions. And then you can also come to the table regardless of your seniority, but more on who you are and what you're contributing to that particular project. And that's why I sort of like encouraging teams to always remove the titles and really as a team, think about what is it that I'm doing here and how are we doing this together and how can we best achieve that? Because then you set foundation for a really good collaborative work environment. And then teams can make, you know, they can do amazing jobs.
I find that it's interesting. It's when this comes back to your point right at the top of the episode about the maturity of the organization. So how ready is an organization to think and work differently, and what is its approach to change? Because it's not just making something new, it's delivering a change into either inside the company or into the marketplace. And I've found a lot of conversations about how organizations are ready to make change in the digital world. It normally is instigated by that coding discipline, the digital engineering discipline, coming in and wanting to talk about agile. And then design follows on after that. But so then you end up in this kind of conversation about, well, they've got their method and we've got our method. And then there's, you know, the thing you said in there that I thought was really interesting was just about the design mindset and that having agreed joint ways of working. That seems to me to be really important. I think that design can be an instigator of that conversation, but if it wants to own the method, it sometimes would fall short, because you said it's a joint way of working.
Absolutely. And that, you know, I mean, we had our design processes. We had that in place, but no one knew about it, and it was not documented anywhere. And maybe we all did it slightly different because we came from different backgrounds, right? But what I knew was that the only way for it really to work and increase impact is if it was something that was owned by a process office, right? So it needed to be company-wide endorsed. And then in the end, it actually was a collaborative work between innovation lead and the process lead and me in a design lead. So it was a triangular collaboration to achieve the process and the approach and the mindset. So that is now being rolled out, that will sort of like help everyone really driving towards a more shared goal. But I think what's important here, and you mentioned the digital and the physical, because I think it's very easy to get stuck in, you know, if the physical world is working according to waterfall, just simply because tools takes 10 weeks to produce, you know, like, and there's certain kind of like steps that has to be taken in the physical world, right? And digital doesn't have that. It's all agile, and you can see the impact of what you do immediately, right? And, you know, waterfall and agile in not the mindset, but the agile processes in digital, they are almost like oil and water. You can't mix them. But we kind of like started talking about it in the way that you can, like emulsion, you know, like when you spin oil and water fast enough, you kind of like really, you can drive it together, but they can fall apart in their original properties without any problem. And we were talking about design thinking is actually the emulsion of between these, because design thinking is the mindset that helps you connect between the two. And then you have to zoom in and zoom out and where you are. And so what we did was we said, it doesn't matter where you are in using these tools and these processes and these mindsets. It is possible to use it if you set out a vision, you know, like we're working on these North Star innovation projects based on a purpose-led setups in highly multifunctional collaborative way, and setting the goal and aligning our roadmaps towards that, you know, really thorough, well orchestrated innovation pipelines. And of course you have to use this upfront when you don't know what you're actually going to tackle. It's just looking at an opportunity in a large field. But then when you do know what you want to tackle, then you need to create the intent of that. And again, these mindsets and these tools works equally well for that. And then when you have something in the market, or you just need to develop it first and then you have it in the market, it continues working, but then in a different way. So our software products team will still work with that mindset and that approach, but maybe on a week basis, while in a vision project, it is half a year to a year of an activity, right? So that's the beauty of it. It can scale and scale in and scale out. And I think maybe I differ a little bit I've heard some conversations as well on your podcast and in other contexts as well, about the whole thing about, do we believe in design thinking or not? And I guess it's back to, what's the definition of design thinking? Because if we say that design thinking is a process, if we say that it is a five-step thing, then I agree, we don't believe in it. But if we say that design thinking is what Stanford taught their engineers about how designers think, then it is evolving all the time. And it will never stagnate. So design thinking in those days was different from how it was in 2005 when service design started coming along to what it is today in an exponential experience-based world that needs, you know, humanity-centric approaches.
Yeah.
And to me, design thinking is evolving with designers' ability to look at more and more complex problems and taking a more of a whole system approach. Design thinking has no limitations in that sense. It's only limited by our definition of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, I would go around a lot of places to say, well, I want to talk about design-led thinking, or I want to talk about design thinking mindset, but I find the biggest challenge when you do lay out some aspects of that and people see it as a process. And that was the hardest message I always found to try and get across. The hardest, but also the simplest message in a way. It's not a process. But you've laid it out. It's not a process. But there are these steps. They can help you order your thinking, but it's not a process. And even designers, once they've seen it, they go, oh, well, my stakeholders are liking this and they're understanding that. And so now we've got something to tell stakeholders to start with and finish with. So we've got to stick to that. No, got to go back and remember this is your mindset. So you can do this in a moment. You can do this in a day, in a week. You know, my best thing that I had on that was, because people at work always used to, you know, say that Marston sees diamonds everywhere, because I found the double diamond a very useful frame of reference. Again, saying it's not a process, but just the divergent and convergent thinking. And I remember distinctly once at one place that I was working at one of the banks, sitting down with the agile coaches and saying, look, everybody's saying that our things are in conflict. You're not getting what you want out of design. Design's feeling pushed and rushed around in agile. So what's going to tell me about agile? Now, I knew a bit about it, but I'm not an expert. And he described it to me and said, and as he was talking to me, I was doing that kind of divergent convergent with my hands. I was like, okay, so, you know, initially you're trying to understand all of the things, and then you're narrowing down to a list of things that then you go into this cycle of. And he talked to me about a kind of 2-week cycle and a daily rhythm. And we just mapped out this divergent convergent thinking that was going on inside it. And I said, we think the same way. And he said, oh, great. I need you to do that on the backlog. And he's like, great. So we kind of, you know, he had this diagram with a backlog, and I turned the double diamond to go down the backlog. And so we'll do that thinking on that. And you're already doing a divergent convergent thinking in your 2-week sprint cycles. And from that moment, the agile coaches and the design thinking coaches were able to work together because it was mindset, right? Mindset. Absolutely. So, I mean, I'm absolutely fascinated to hear about how you've instigated this cultural change in design at Electrolux. As you said yourself, a bottom-up approach, not a top-down approach. And so many people will default to top-down approach. I've been given this position, therefore I'm going to use that. And it sounds to me like you invested in the bottom-up and then used judiciously or in a kind of specific way, the top-down position. What are your reflections now? You're stepping away from the role of CDO at Electrolux. And so stepping away from that CDO role now with some perspective, what is your kind of reflection back on the key aspects of the role of CDO?
I think you have to be an executive. Right. I like the way Peter Merholtz talk about it, that you have to work like 30% upwards, 30% sideways, and 30% downwards. But I guess those numbers would differ depending on where you are on that journey in terms of what needs most work and where you how you divide yourself over it. And so I would say he frames it quite nicely, actually. So I'll reference that. He talks about, you know, you need to be an executive leader and a part of understanding the organizational and strategy of the organization and the business ambitions to be able to translate that into design strategies and also create an understanding for why that's needed back into the executive team. And then, of course, create milestones and measures of how you're going to go there, right? And then you have to, as well, be that creative leader, which sets a certain standard and a certain. I do believe that to get designers with you, you have to have enough knowledge about design to be able to. You don't have to be a trained design leader, an amateur designer. Believe that we have enough senior design leader out there, which are great and been doing a whole career in design. But you have to have the ability to creatively discuss with the team and set a vision and work towards that vision and set the quality standards in that sense. And then you have the people responsibility and you have the operational responsibility where, you know, more and more you have the ops, design ops set up. The way we've done it in Electrolux is we talk about design effectiveness. And I really like that word because it talks about the investments that you do in design should be used in its most effective way. So you take responsibility that goes beyond maybe resourcing and time reporting and the operational structure, who should be where and at what time, but really also build the culture by driving events, making the community come together, connecting the dots, making sure that people know who's working on what, so that you help people take away waste in the organization, bridging those silos, etc. And then I think for me personally, what I felt was maybe the there's many successes, but if it was one thing that I felt and feel incredibly proud of, it is the way we've managed to integrate research in design. Mm-hmm. And it was always there a little bit. I would say designers were working because it's a tool that we use, right? But it was a little bit more skunk work. You right. did what you needed to do to get the answers that you needed, but it was not seen as something that was part of what we were expected to do. And we have worked incredibly hard within design, but also beyond design, to get the right understanding on how design research complements insights, and which is often sitting in marketing, or at least working more on a high level innovation ambition, which is, you know, super important. I wouldn't underestimate the value of our insight team and the innovation research and the future research, you know, all that stuff. But design research is a complementary capability that really helps design inform the design decisions, either if it is in a vision project or if it is a sprint or whatever it is, right? We do. So we did that through applying research again. So, you know, really understanding what the other research function within the company were thinking and their understanding. And then build the collaboration in a very good way, and that created a bit better understanding. And that now there's this research alliance in the place, which helps different research capabilities to keep each other informed, but still working where they need to be, and making, in our case, then the design researchers, making the designers more skilled in using research in their projects. And I think that's such a fundamental capability within design to have matured that and really achieved that as one of the fundamental, I would say, cross-functionally capabilities, cross-disciplinary capabilities.
That's great to hear. I you know, my first role in design was as a researcher, so that's words that are, you know, dear to my heart. But also I'm seeing and having a lot of conversations with people where that focus on research is the important spearhead that kind of helps bring through the value, because that insight is for everybody in the organization, as well as needed by, I mean, so needed, as you said, by designers, but it's for everybody. As you said, there are marketing insights, there's innovation insights, there are other types. They also tend to, at times, in some organizations, get kept to those functions, or they're for a moment in the cycle. So when design research comes in, it either fills that out and fills out some gaps in the spread of research, or in some organizations, there isn't enough insight in other places. So, and it's a thing you can give, you know, so that you, if you don't hold on to it, so you don't look like you're like just building this design capability, because you give this insight to the rest of the organization. It's incredibly
It goes two ways. I mean, very often, you know, we would be super inspired by a deck of research that unfold a lot of opportunities and challenges. But we would, in a way, think, okay, that gives us a great starting point, but it doesn't answer our questions, because we have questions on a complete different depth. So then you do this new level of research, and then again, it feeds up because it's back informing back the opportunity, right? So indeed, it is an extremely powerful tool. And we talked about processes and the importance of designing processes and not necessarily being stuck in a couple of steps. And it just makes me think about, we had this project where we wanted to understand users' behavior on sustainability within a certain context over the world. And we started off just talking to very few people in all different locations. I think we had like 6 locations across the world, with maybe just 2 or 3 people in each location. So not a big sample group. And then there were particularly a few people that we felt were having an enormous interest in the subject, and we picked those to do like a co-creation And I was sitting into this process. It was, three designers that had a conversation with a woman from New York. And so one was facilitating the conversation. Another one was on my row, right? And another one was taking, everyone was in different locations, of course. And one was taking notes of the conversation. And then there was another one working on the Miro board somewhere else, sort of putting sketches and ideas based on what was heard. And through the research and by the end of the conversation, the moderator could go and say, well, okay, well, we heard all this from you. So is this what you actually would see as an optimum solution, right? And then you got a conversation around a very rough sketch. But it was so powerful because there you actually, instead of, divergent and convergent in, a few weeks or in a sprint, you're actually doing it in the conversation. And then you can take that with you into your next conversation. And that's how you kind of like building. And I believe that the way we need to design nowadays in really thinking about so many different angles, we have to just constantly evolve hypotheses and stress test them in different contexts. And as such, put new requirements on the solutions as we're expanding the view and our understanding of what we need to do. So it's a very exciting time to be a designer, I would say.
Absolutely. Pernilla, I'd like to ask you one other question. The question I'd like to ask you is about accountabilities as a CDO. You've mentioned this bottom-up approach to building up the design team, elevating and empowering them. Now, I then asked you a little bit about, what you needed to do as a chief design officer to then make sure that the path was clear for them and enabled for them to be the way that you're training them up to be. You've talked about collaborating with your stakeholders, the round table of leadership, and bringing people together jointly. What are the actual accountabilities of a chief design officer, do you think? I mean, maybe either from your experience at Electrolux or your reflection on what you think they should be in the future, beyond the accountability of the people that you're looking at and beyond the accountability of there is design process and design governance in place. Are there other accountabilities that make for there being a chief design officer role as opposed to a VP of design reporting to somebody else?
I mean, I think it would require that you are in the actual executive leadership, I would say. It depends, again, a little bit on the organization and the structure. But in a perfect world, I would think that the people around the table, the seats on an executive leadership level in a company would have to be made up out of a mix of both specialists and generalists. And I'm saying that because I think there are, in many cases, on a senior leadership level, the individuals that comes to that level have often come there through having experienced different parts of an organization. And we know this from other conversations that you have. I think it was with Jose you addressed this, right? So you have people that have been in purchasing R&D and, product management or whatever, right? And then they've seen a big part of the organization and they can represent those functions in a good way. And there are other functions where that is not so commonly happening, right? So design is one of them, but I would argue that marketing and brand are another. And then I think it is important to acknowledge that you actually need specialists in these areas. I do believe that there is an importance for companies to also expand the roles of design leaders if there is not enough seats on the table, right? How do you actually grow your design leaders to take on a larger part? I mean, sometimes it can combine, design and brand combines quite nicely. And then the same thing about design and innovation combines quite nicely. So you have certain functions that can be clustered in an easier way to still make that relevant. But I do think the key thing is to actually acknowledge that you also need specialism in this. And I think I read an article about, I mean, Apple is the company that always comes up, right? But I read an article about them, how they really sort of celebrated the functional specialism on a very senior leadership level, because then the people that sit in that leadership group can, with actually strong knowledge and conviction, talk about the subject and then support, the multifunctional activities to take place in the organization. Instead of everyone sitting being generalists. So for me, that's all part of the diversity that we need in corporations. You need diversity, not just on, gender or geographies or ethnicity. You also need diversity in thinking, and you need diversity in experiences. Mm-hmm. I was personally extremely inspired when I heard about a CEO that had made a point of having all functions of the company represented on his board, so that, they could advise the company in a more holistic way and more true to what the company really needed to achieve. To me, that sounded like a really amazing setup.
Excellent. Well, Pernilla, thank you so much for joining me today in this conversation. It's been really great to hear just your journey to becoming the Chief Design Officer, and then the approach that you've been taking. It's really a specific context around Electrolux, around why you've taken the approach that you have. The challenge, I think, nicely laid down for people to look at how you enable and empower and elevate the design, the team through culture. And then, as I think I said before, judiciously use your role as CDO to unlock the things that can help that going forward. Focus on research as a spearhead for the team and for the company. Thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Business by Design, a podcast that explores the evolving nature of design leadership and how to scale design's impact in the world. Don't forget to check out the show notes for links and resources from our guests, and a link to the fabulous team at Tech Circus who produce this podcast. Tech Circus are leaders in curating inspirational content for inspired professionals, and this podcast is just one of many events that they produce for the product, tech, and design community. I'm your host, Martin Dowson, and if you'd like to hear more content like this, then please do follow the podcast. And also, take a moment to subscribe to our newsletter, where you can find out more about upcoming shows and, really importantly, how to connect back with me and the team so that we can hear your feedback and suggestions for future episodes. I'd really like to hear more from you, our listeners, about who you'd like to hear from next. Until next time, thank you for listening to Business by Design.